Welcome back to the Intellectual Explorers podcast. In today's episode, I had an exploration with Rebecca Fox. Rebecca is an author of a few graphic novels on how to be a skeptic and a host for a podcast called The Seeker and the Skeptic, where Rebecca and her friend Kat explore all sorts of woo, esoteric, paranormal, and spiritual topics. In this conversation, we discuss stoicism, woo, new atheism, skepticism, street epistemology, conspiracy theories, and more. All right, enjoy this exploration I had with Rebecca. Today, I'm exploring with Rebecca Fox. Before we begin, I'm going to anchor myself in an exploratory mindset. My intention is to engage in this dialogue with the spirit of exploration. I'm not here to agree or disagree, but to be a performative agnostic and understand my interlocutor's map of reality and possibly explore new territory together. That being said, Rebecca, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So we met at Stoicon, which is
in Athens,
which is for the listeners, it's the International Stoic Conference that happens once a year, and then this year it happened in Athens.
I thought you were going to explain what Athens was for listeners. Athens is the city.
I'll let my listeners Google that one. and then we just randomly met, I think, after with a group of your friends, and we had a really good chat. It was probably one of the best chats I had at the Stoicon.
Aww.
And then we just exchanged information, and then we, you know, we added each other on Twitter and stuff like that, and said, "Hey, let's go on each other's podcasts." And then here we are. So
yeah, it was an amazing. It was an amazing conference, full stop. But an amazing place, sort of venue to meet and chat with people, because obviously everyone who's there is interested in philosophy. This is why you're at Stoicon. And then there was just this beautiful white marble, you know, everything, and then like fragrant herbs coming out of all the planters on the sides, tortoises wandering around, people bringing you wine. It was amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know, that was pretty nice. The after party. So what was your take on Stoicism and the conference as a whole, because I know you did a podcast episode on Stoicism specifically.
Yeah, well, this is kind of a weird episode for us, because my podcast, The Seeker and the Skeptic, we usually go and experience things that some people might call woo, things that I call woo often, and then report back. And I obviously come from a more skeptical perspective, or maybe not obviously, and my friend comes from a less skeptical perspective, the seeker. But we thought it'd be fun to do something that I was invested in, and I, you know, because I'm interested in Stoicism already. It was one of those like reversal shows. We're thinking about doing other ones on like atheism and skepticism too. But this was our first of that type. So I did feel a bit on the spot, and I had a lot more sympathy for Kat when she goes to things like astrology conferences. And it's this weird thing of being there because you care about the thing, but also knowing that you're going to be speaking about the experience of being there in sort of behind their back sort of way. So strange, just a strange sort of being kind of a journalist, like an informal journalist, but also there because you like it. And it's a bit of a confusing space to be in.
And most of the Stoics, or at least the prominent Stoics, like the Donald Robinson or Massimo Piglucci, they're all atheists. So they all kind of like, I feel like the modern Stoic movements, or at least the people who speak on behalf of it, are part of that new atheist, skeptic, kind of broader community.
was that your read as well?
Broadly, yes. I mean, the reason I got into Stoicism is because I heard Massimo Bellucci talking about it on his podcast, which I think of as a skeptic podcast. But this was a long time ago. He's not on that podcast anymore. But that's sort of where I first heard of Stoicism. So I thought of it as like, well, this is perfect. This is like philosophy for skeptics, because one of the things that I talk a lot, I go around and, you know, promote skepticism here and there. Mm-hmm. And I always talk about the importance of reason and compassion, which I saw as being pretty closely aligned with knowledge and justice, the first of the four virtues. And then obviously to actually put those things into action, you need the other two Stoic virtues, temperance and courage. So I was like, well, this fits so nicely with my worldview, and I expected everyone to be skeptics. And mainly they were, although I do think that there's like a sort of underground pantheist sect, or maybe not so underground, but I hadn't encountered them until I was at Stoicon.
Yeah, I don't know what the taxonomy of beliefs are amongst the people who follow it. I think it's pretty, there's a lot of variety there, but I know the people who are sort of the representatives, the authors and stuff like that, they're mostly kind of part of the atheistic family.
Yeah, and when I say pantheist, I mean in like, you know, Spinoza, the very Spinozan way, you know, right, like right, God right. or nature sort of thing. Yeah, yeah. So not like talking to rocks or anything.
Yeah.
Not
yeah,
there's
yeah.
anything wrong with talking to rocks. I've been doing that actually as part of some research for another show, but yeah.
So let's get into your show. Like the seeker and the skeptic, or is it the skeptic and the seeker? I think it's the seeker and the
seeker
skeptic.
Seeker and the skeptic, yeah.
So what is the premise behind it, and how did it start and all that?
Oh, well, we were, we met at Toastmasters, which is like a public speaking
nice.
Club.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're both quite driven people, but we're not, middle-aged men, which was everyone else at that group. So we immediately gravitated towards each other and got on really well. And one of our first conversations we had was about astrology. Kat was just starting to get interested in it, and because she's like kind of like me, a kind of organized driven person, she came to our meetup for coffee with a sort of agenda of what she wanted to talk about, and astrology was on it. We sat and had a chat about it for about an hour, just throwing ideas around and sort of testing different elements of what people believe astrology is, and is this for real? And then both of us went away thinking we should do something with this. Like, this is too good, because it's so rare to have a conversation with someone who is of the opposite opinion to you, or not necessarily opposite opinion, but yeah, who has a vastly different opinion. But we still got on really well, and we have a similar sense of humor, and we're up for having any kind of conversation really. Neither of us offend easily. So it seemed like a really good opportunity to have the sort of conversation that wasn't really going on very often. Because skeptics do tend to do lots of Skeptic and the Skeptic podcasts. That's a popular brand.
Right, right.
And we really like the idea of having those conversations between ourselves, but also creating an audience of people who are both and who are willing to talk to each other.
And so for the seeker, what kind of, it's Kat, is that's her name?
Yeah.
And so what kind of like philosophy or worldview does she have?
Well, she was brought up Christian, and I think she's kind of coming back around to being a deist now, although I wouldn't like to speak for her. Actually, interestingly, she was very compelled by Stoicism when we did the episode on Stoicism, but she focused on a lot of the older Stoics writings, which do suggest some sort of deity, and she really liked that. So she's been following that thread, and that's actually led her towards a more sort of, yeah, religious, I don't know if you call it religious, worldview. But yeah, she's a seeker. She's open to stuff. She's not stuck in any one particular worldview. She's trying new things and looking for opportunities to not necessarily find truth, but find something that fulfills her.
And does that, like, annoy you that you have someone who, you know, is your friend, who's aware of your worldview and your kind of like the seriousness you take on having like a fine-tuned epistemic methodology? Does that annoy you that she's still a seeker?
You know, he really used to, and sometimes it still does. She is annoying. I mean, she's objectively annoying. I'm sure she'd say the same thing about me. She's it's actually been quite good for me, because I genuinely thought that we would have, we've been going for like a year and a half now, and I thought after a year of these conversations, she would become a skeptic, because I would make all the arguments and they'd be so reasonable that there is no way she could possibly deny them, and then we wouldn't have a show anymore. It would ruin the premise of our show. But that hasn't happened at all.
Nice.
Which is annoying, but also has given me some much needed humility, probably. So.
Right, right. So what kind of areas have you explored, or topics have you explored on your podcast? And like, what was the decision to choose those type of topics?
We basically do what we want. I mean, that's the beauty of podcasting, right? We've focused mainly on things that you'd probably think of as like in the New Age pantheon. So flotation tanks, holotropic breathing. We've done past life regression. That episode isn't out yet, but that's a thing that we've done. We went to a guy who channeled aliens, the Palladians to be specific, not just any aliens, and the Archangel Michael. He was fun. And we did ayahuasca. We went to meet some people who follow Thelema, which is the religion that Aleister Crowley invented. Also, yeah, everything, but mainly things that are kind of on the border between religion and, I don't know, woo. So, like somewhere there, not, although we do have these things on our spreadsheet. We have a spreadsheet with all of our ideas, and we have things like anti-vax and things like that on it, but we haven't touched anything quite like that yet. And that's mainly because I'm so far from a scientist, it's laughable. And I don't feel like I can do a good job on that yet. But so mainly sort of spiritual things.
Mm. And you mentioned the word woo. Like, what? Yeah. How would you define woo? Because I know a lot of people in the skeptic community, you know, use that word and throw it around a lot.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? It's like, I didn't realize how, well, I guess I did it. So I first heard it, I think, from an American skeptic. And I just thought this must be an American word that I'm not familiar with because I'm not American. But it's actually kind of a word that skeptics use, and people who are familiar with the skeptics community use it. But outside the skeptics community, I'm not sure how well known it is. I had this horrible, it wasn't that horrible. That's a bit of an exaggeration. But I went to do a talk about how to change people's minds, sort of playing with some of the sort of theories and strategies from street epistemology. And I used the word woo a couple of times in this talk, just because it's a useful word to try and capture this stuff. And afterwards, I got an email from, I was speaking to an audience of skeptics in the pub, so I expected everyone to be skeptics. I got an email from a woman who wasn't a skeptic who was in the audience, and she hadn't known what the word was. And she went home and Googled it, naturally. And she found the definition, which is, I don't know, the first thing that comes up on Google, which specifically says it's derogatory. I can read it to you, actually. I've got it here. It says, relating to or holding unconventional beliefs regarded as having little or no scientific basis, especially those relating to spirituality, mysticism, or alternative medicine. I kind of thought of it as a neutral word, but right there in the definition, it says derogatory. So I felt bad, and I apologized to her. And I really thought, maybe I'll try and give up this word. I wrote like a personal essay about maybe skeptics should consider retiring this word. How useful is it? But it's really hard to get it out of your vocabulary because it captures this huge group of things that aren't necessarily, like, I can't give you like necessary and sufficient criteria for what is woo. But there's this like, I know it when I see it type of thing. Like there's a familial resemblance between certain things. But I wish there was a better word. And I'm not entirely comfortable. I think maybe it might mean something like things people like us think are nonsense, which is not a good thing to say. But like in usage, that is what it does seem to mean.
It, you know, it might be helpful to talk about skepticism and that whole community, because some of my listeners might not be familiar with it. Because I remember when you and I first met, I just sort of like, oh, you're part of a new atheist, you know, kind of tribe. He says, no, I'm a skeptic. So there's a difference there in your mind between the two.
For sure, yeah.
And so I think maybe like an understanding of like the skeptical movement might kind of flesh out what woo is.
Yeah. So, I mean, skepticism is hard to describe. You're just telling me to define all these things that are impossible to define, but I'll give it a go. Obviously, like ever since people have been making claims that they can't back up, people have been skeptical in sort of the normal use of the word about it, going like, oh, I don't think that's true. And there's a whole body of literature of like, you know, there used to be people who, for example, would like pretend that they'd like crack an egg open and then they'd produce a snake out of it. This is like in ancient Greek times. They're all wearing togas when this was happening to set the scene. And some guy would say, I don't think that you've really, that's not real magic. Like, you've done some sleight of hand there. So there's like a tradition going back to probably the beginning of humanity of people who just question and refuse to accept at face value what other people are saying when it seems ridiculous to them. So that's what kind of like the way deep history of skepticism. And the modern skeptical movement, I think it took off in like the 70s, more or less. And there were a couple of big reasons why, but I think the main thing was a concern for consumer protection. So you have this time where a lot of people are trying to sell cures for diseases, trying to sell tickets to shows where people claim they can talk to your dead relatives, all these things. And the main concern of the skeptics movement at that time, at least, was we don't want people wasting money, getting hurt, potentially, you know, really badly hurt or killed. There is a website, I can't remember, it's whatstheharm.net, I think, that is set up by some skeptics, and they calculate the amount of people who have been seriously injured or killed by pseudoscientific things, such as, you know, people pretending they can cure cancer with strange concoctions and stuff. Anyway, so the skeptics movement sort of arose again, or the modern skeptics movement arose to combat those people, those woos, who were trying to trick people. And this is why they're so closely associated with magicians and magic, because magicians are really good at spotting when someone is using an old magician's trick. And that's what a lot of these people were doing. So I guess that's kind of the genesis. But then they sort of had to create a sort of a philosophy, or like a reason why they're doing what they're all up to. And I think it was always slightly disputed, but I would define it roughly as trying to eliminate as many biases as you possibly can, like educating yourself about potential ways that you can make mistakes in your thinking. And this is why skeptics are always so famous for saying, that's a logical fallacy, that's a cognitive bias. Like, labeling everything is really obnoxious, but we can't help it. We've assimilated all this information. We just have to spit it out every opportunity. And then ideally, the practices, so there's the knowledge and the practice of skepticism would be applying that to your own thinking, really trying to strip back all of those potential mistakes you can get, so you're thinking as clearly as you possibly can. Mm. And then along with that, as far as I see it, is like an orientation towards truth. Like basically skeptics think that truth is important. And by truth, I mean sort of like, you know, objective reality, trying to get as close to that as we possibly can. I think most skeptics would defend the idea that objective reality exists, which is not, you know, not everyone does, but I think they would. And they would also acknowledge that science is the best way to get knowledge about the objective reality. But hopefully they would admit that you can't have total knowledge, because that would be hubris. But yeah, so you've got these people, they start off, they're just trying to defend the public, consumer protection. And then this sort of philosophy, rough philosophy, it's not really even a philosophy, it's a method of thinking and of being, evolves around that. And then, I don't know, like in the 2000s when I got involved, there was just massive conferences and, you know, people talking about interesting ideas and like tearing each other down and raising each other up. And it was just like this really bawdy, crazy time, which felt really fun. And it felt like we were all in something really important and really trying to help people to think better and help each other to think better. Mm-hmm. And I guess it's kind of continued in that vein, although I do feel like it's on the wane, especially in the US now, just because of all sorts of things that have affected all sorts of movements. Basically, right. Yeah, got a bit political, mm-hmm. which is always poison for a movement. And I think also, like, it would have been really nice if we could stick to this idea of skepticism as a method, but it's so tempting to say, and I have this temptation too, of course, that my conclusions I've reached using the skeptical method are actually, you know, the same conclusions you guys should reach. Mm-hmm. And that's when it gets a bit, well, it gets a bit not skepticism. It becomes something else.
Mm-hmm. And I want to double click on that and kind of mention sort of my experience with people that sort of like the arrogance I've encountered, because I have this group called Intellectual Explorers Club. Mm. And it kind of invites all sorts of different people with all sorts of different beliefs. I guess the frame is so broad. And then, you know, we're officially a performative agnostic. So we're just sort of inviting people to understand their worldview. And some of the people that what I dubbed the part of the new atheists, like they're like, you know, love Sam Harris. They've only read Richard Dawkins or Christopher Hitchens. Mm-hmm. And then they just like, they're looking for a fight. Like I think militant atheist is the term. And then they get sort of like upset when someone is not an atheist or someone believes something counter. And there's this like almost this cartoonish arrogance sometimes, like, oh, it's okay that you're wrong. Like they say things like that before they engage in an argument. And so I want to inquire into that. Have you picked that up? Because I don't get that from you at all.
Thank you. You got me in a good day.
Yeah. So do you sense that in the amongst the community of skeptics?
Oh, for sure. Like, yeah, there are definitely people like that amongst skeptics. And I think I've been around talking to groups of skeptics, and it's very interesting to think about their different motivations for being there and their motivations for behaving in the way they do. I think, well, for me, I find it very difficult. I have this kind of, and this is just a personality thing. It's not like a virtue I'm committed to, although maybe it is, but it's convenient. It's also just part of my personality. I find lying very difficult and misrepresenting things very difficult. And if someone is having, if you just said something like, and then I went to get my chakra cleansed and then carried on talking, I'd be like, Peter, can we double click on that? Because I feel like if I don't say something, then it's going to pass and I won't have been honest with you about how I feel about that. So that's a very charitable interpretation for why skeptics might, you know, say, well, actually, because if they just thought, well, actually, and didn't say it, then it's just a weird way to live. I do also obviously acknowledge there are lots of people who just enjoy being mean to people and sort of are just arrogant by nature. There's not much you can do about those people. I've noticed when I go and do a talk about skepticism to a group of skeptics, which is a delight because it's a home audience. But I'm sort of trying to refresh people on the basics, which often get left behind. Someone will almost like, I don't know exactly what it is, but they obviously have this thing where they feel they have to disagree with whoever is the speaker. And so they're going to put their hand up and disagree with me, even though I'm a skeptic and I have exactly the same opinions as them, but they're just searching for something to disagree with. Mm. Maybe I'm just, you know, maybe I'm saying nonsense and they're right to disagree. But often I feel like the motivation is not, I would like to have a conversation with you, maybe correct a wrong idea that you have and we can move closer to the truth together. I feel like often the motivation is, I'm signaling to everyone that I'm even cleverer than the person on the stage talking about skepticism. But generally I do notice there's a big difference. People who organize skeptics in the pub in the UK, it's all like just grassroots. Like everyone's just doing it in their spare time. No one gets paid for it. They just do it because they care about critical thinking. And they are always super passionate and have the same attitude as I do. It's often just a small percentage of the people who come along but are not actively involved who have that more arrogant attitude, in my experience anyway.
Mm. And we were talking about this before we pressed record. Is that like is there a difference between new atheism and skepticism? And
absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, because my read on the whole origins of the new atheist movement was sort of started with Richard Dawkins. They started putting out all these documentaries, sort of these anti-woo, anti-religious documentaries, and then sort of the four horsemen of the new atheist movement: Sam Harris, Daniel Dennett, and Christopher Hitchens. With Richard Dawkins, they started talking, and then they started producing books, and it seemed like a movement started evolving around them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, one thing, skepticism has been around much longer than new atheism. I mean, it's new, it's in the name. So I think that sort of kicks off in the late 90s, early 2000s. So skepticism has already sort of been established, and there's established organizations doing skepticism. But the important difference is atheism is a conclusion that many people reach when they think about the world and philosophy skeptically. Skepticism is the method. It shouldn't necessitate any particular conclusion. In fact, there was a guy Martin Gardner, American guy, who was one of the founders, I think, of PsyCop, or one of those big American skeptical organizations. He was a deist. And there did used to be people, I don't know if this is true anymore, because I haven't met one, but there did used to be people, not just people coming along, but people, you know, leading lights of the movement who were deists. So they were really committed to the method of skepticism. And from their perspective, they were like, well, faith is a whole different question. Faith is just something, it's not amenable to science, because the whole, the method of skepticism only really applies to testable claims. If your claims aren't testable, then, you know, go for your life, basically, was their attitude. So, and like, I find it very strange to see how someone could reach that conclusion, but I really liked the idea. When I first got into skepticism, I really liked the idea there were people who had come to dramatically different conclusions than me using the same method. And I just thought that was an interesting and fun environment to be in, because you have this, you have an agreement on epistemology, you have an agreement on the tools you're using to address these problems. So you're speaking the same language, but you've come to a different conclusion. How interesting, how fun to hash out those differences.
When I think of like the modern critical thinking courses, it almost feels like, and I'm talking the realm of feelings now, almost feels like the equivalent of apologist courses of when teaching reasons. It's like once we teach you good reasoning and logical fallacies and all this stuff, it's a foregone conclusion almost that you'll be an atheist, just like it is a foregone conclusion you believe in God. Where and that just kind of, it's off-putting to me when I see people talk like that in the critical thinking realm.
Yeah. Yeah, but you can see, I mean, I can see how that is tempting to, I mean, I do kind of think that way. I just said, like, I thought if I talked to Kat long enough, she'd become a skeptic. There is this, like, it's, I mean, at least for me, it's very hard to project into other people's heads and imagine they could come to different conclusions using the same methods or the same information I have. Like, that just, it floors me. It's confusing. It's weird. People are weird, I've noticed. So I guess you don't need to be able to understand it, really. You just have to accept it and then be nice about it. But I think people don't understand it, and therefore they never get to acceptance and they never get to niceness. And they end up just being a bit like, I guess it almost feels manipulative, right? Like you're being led to a particular conclusion.
Right, right. So circling back to the new atheist, the skepticism divide. So it seems like to me that the skeptics community came around first. It's kind of like around the consumer protectionist aspect. And then they sort of almost merged. Is that the idea with the new atheists when they were started arising?
Maybe in America, because, you know, conferences being what they are, and that's where a lot of these people get together and communities form at conferences. I think a lot of skeptics are atheists. The majority of skeptics are atheists. Maybe even you could say, you know, all skeptics are atheists, pretty much. Anyone who identifies as a skeptic nowadays is probably an atheist. So they're going to be going to the same conferences. They're going to be listening to the same podcasts. They're going to be hanging out together. Kind of makes sense. But here in Europe, well, I can't really speak for all of Europe, but definitely in the UK, you know, like in the last census, or it might not be a census, but in the last survey of religiosity in the UK, which was last year, 2018, they said that like it's for like 51%, I think, of people have no religion. Mm-hmm. So like atheist isn't really a very good label when it's over half the population. That would like me be getting really excited about me being a woman. It's like, well, it's not that uncommon, is it? It's like, it's a weird identity to invest anything in when it's so common. Mm-hmm. So I think here, skepticism is a much bigger deal, and atheism is almost taken for granted. Like no one really talks about it that much unless they're talking to an American audience. Mm, but then again, I do live in a town that was called the most godless city in the UK. So I have a slightly distorted perception, perhaps. I didn't encounter Christianity until I was at university, and I just made some offhand bitchy comment about God. And the girl I was sitting next to tapped the cross around her neck and was like,
wow.
Yeah, we ended up being great friends. So it's a happy ending to that story. But it never occurred to me to watch my language about Christianity or, you know, to be sensitive to the idea that someone might be a Christian, because it was just outside my frame of reference.
So you weren't raised a Christian? You were raised an atheist in a way?
Well, not explicitly atheist, just kind of like nothing.
Right.
Yeah. But I had a really hardcore flirtation with neo-paganism through my 20s. So I have some exposure to religion.
Well, so what do you mean by neo-paganism? Like what aspects of it? Like Wicca?
Oh, well, specifically Wicca. Like right, I came across it when I was a teen, probably. My dad married this woman who was a shaman. So she used to go and give healing sessions and all sorts of stuff at these mind, body, spirit fairs. So we were dragged around, all the kids were dragged around to those things and exposed to all those ideas. And Wicca just, I mean, it just blew my mind. It was the perfect religion for me. It was all about, I still am, I'm a complete nature geek. I'm obsessed with animals and birds and trees. Animals are birds. I know that because I'm a nature geek. But yeah, I love that. So I love that aspect of it. I love the idea of feeling at home in the country I live in and in the landscape that I lived in, because my home life was just a bit of a mess, as you can imagine, with a shaman for a stepmom. So, so that feeling of home, of community, of connection to a tradition that I believed at the time, because this is what Wiccans will tell you or would have told you in the 90s. I think a lot of them have been more skeptical of their own sacred history now, that this is like the same religion that our Neolithic ancestors practiced around Stonehenge and all these beautiful monuments, which I used to hang out at as a kid. I mean, there's no better place to go drinking with your friends when you're teenagers than like a long barrow. So this was, it was very, very comforting to me. And along with all that, of course, the big thing that everyone knows about witches is they practice magic. So that was a big part of my life too. And then I guess like in my mid-20s, I saw the light and became a skeptic.
That's one thing. When I was talking to you and we were talking online and we met in Stoicon, I get a sense that there's a sympathy you have for, you know, people who believe in untraditional things like Wicca or other woo type topics. And there's this, I even get a sense, and correct me if I'm wrong, that there's a desire to want to believe in them still.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe that's your interest in exploring all this topics. So maybe, yeah. Can you like inquire into that or sense into that? If that's
true. I definitely want to believe. I mean, I don't think that's just a me thing. I think, well, maybe I want to believe more than the average person, but I want something that makes sense of all this. As much as I can talk the talk of, you know, of atheism and be like, well, everything, you know, the natural world's beautiful. We make our own meaning. Why do we need anything more? I mean, I'm a human being. I'm compelled by narratives. I love the idea of, especially the sort of, I mean, and it's always that stuff, the earth spirituality, as they call it, that calls to me, you know, the idea of talking to trees and, you know, all that stuff. It feels emotionally very compelling and rich to me. And I think in some ways, all the exploration into the world of woo has made me, I've always been sympathetic to it, but it's made me more like, okay, if someone could just give me a reasoned argument for this, I would be so on board so fast. Like you wouldn't be able to stop me. I would have my incense out. I'd have my long floaty skirt. I'd be down there at Stonehenge. In fact, maybe I will just go anyway. We're thinking about going this midsummer, but yeah, I'm compelled by it. I think it's beautiful and interesting, and I really like the people. They're lovely people. I'm talking specifically about neo-paganism. Right. We've met some less savory characters in the world of woo, obviously, as well. But I want to believe for sure, and I just have to be careful with myself, because my confirmation bias will run wild, and I will literally believe anything if I let myself.
So this is a point of inquiry that I want to go down. I know, at least with the what I'm dubbing the new atheist that I've met in Toronto that I know of, and then the street epistemologists who seem like friendly new atheists to me. Yeah. And then, you know, the skeptics that I'm learning about, it's more about like a methodology, or at least that's what it started out as. They all have, it's almost seems like to me, it's like they're against something, you know, it's people who are creating a community, against tools, thoughts that sort of tear down a previous belief system or kind of like refine your own thinking and stuff like that. But they don't offer a way of life, a philosophy as a way of life, like how one should live. You think that's an accurate read?
I don't know if I can speak for new atheists, but definitely for skeptics. A good skeptic shouldn't tell you how to live your life or what to do. All it is a way of thinking. Like it's super boring, really. It's just about, you know, about using the tools of knowing how your brain works, metacognition, basically keeping on top of that. And when you have an idea that you, or something that you think is true, just holding it lightly, you know, proportionate to the evidence. So don't ever get so stuck on an idea that you can't let it go. That should be what skepticism is. And that's what my skepticism is. So it definitely doesn't offer you anything in the way of like, this is how you should live your life. Although I do think that skeptics generally do have an idea of how you should live your life, but that is not articulated in their, you know, in their mission statements. Nothing to do with skepticism. It's just something we pick up from, I don't know where, the general culture, I suppose. Mm.
So it's like the whole is and ought kind of gap.
Yes, exactly. Getting. Yeah. Skeptics are leery of talking about values.
Right.
And so, and when they do, they kind of get themselves in trouble, like Sam Harris did with The Moral Landscape.
Right. Right. So the idea there, it's street epistemology or skeptics or new atheists are like, they're refining the is, like, let's make sure we are, you know, we don't get outside the scope of what is or what we think could be. Let's have a method that really fine tunes that. But then speaking confidently about the ought, that's when it comes to values. So maybe this is why attraction to stoicism exists.
Yeah. Although I do think, as I said, skepticism started, as far as I see it, modern skepticism started in consumer protection. And like, why bother protecting consumers unless you care about them? And that's like, I know it's a very boring, simple value. So there's nothing to it really, but that idea of compassion, like, there's no reason for us to care about someone being ripped off by someone pretending to be a psychic, or someone, you know, dying because they've been given something that they told them would cure cancer, which actually doesn't. There's no reason for us to care unless we have a value. And I kind of identify that as compassion. And those are the two, reason and compassion, truth and heart. That's the kind of two things I see going on in skepticism. But people don't talk about the compassion part so much. And I think the reason why they don't is because how do you justify a value? You can't really, not with reason. So unless you're Sam Harris, in which case you think you can. And I think he does quite a convincing job, but he hasn't convinced me all the way.
Hmm. One thing about religion, or people say, is that they sort of bake in the is and ought there. So you get, you know, the best of both worlds.
Yeah.
And if you tear down religion, you might have the is, but then you don't have that ought, that you don't have that confident ought. So do you think that explains maybe partly your longing or desire for woo?
Yeah, it could well be. The thing is, I am pretty clear about my values, and I don't have any ground for them, so to speak. But I don't think really, I mean, as an atheist, I don't think a Christian has ground for their values either, because I think their ground is something that they made up. So I don't really think it puts me in a very different position. Like, I have values of like trying to cause as little suffering as possible to other beings in this planet. Very basic value, which lots of people share. And probably a lot of Christians share that too. And you ask them why they have that value, maybe they would say God. And I'd just be like, I don't know, I just have it. But why is they're saying God, to me as an atheist, is no more valuable than me saying, I don't know. It's just, I mean, I could give you the reason evolutionarily and blah, blah, blah. But there's no like rational, there's nothing behind that. Mm. There's nothing underneath that, I guess. Which is a weird thing to accept, because, sorry, I'm just like thinking off the top of my head and I might not be making sense. But I wonder whether we have this idea that we need to have a justification, because for years and years, religion has given us a justification for our values. It said, the reason you have these values is because God gave them to you, or whatever. Mm. That somehow some kind of spiritual thing happened and you have these values. And so now it's not enough to just say, I have these values, because you're like, yeah, but why? But that's a kind of weird question, because it's kind of like if you think about, you know, the death of God, or, you know, God being taken out of the human psyche, and there's a hole, and that hole is exactly the same size and shape as God. So we just have to find something to fit in it.
Mm.
But we like, why? Why is it the same size and shape? And why are we assuming it's fillable?
Mm.
I don't know. Yeah. It's confusing. It's very hard. I think the reason why skeptics don't like to talk about values, and often philosophy at all, to be honest, is because it gets us into the realm of talking about feelings. And, you know,
right. And I was just
that's gonna, scary.
Yeah, I just wanted to talk about feelings, actually. So the one thing that was salient was you just said is that you have values, you're pretty clear on them, but it was groundless in a way. And then you said, oh, people who are religious, even though they say they have a ground for their values, you know, they're just making it up. So they're groundless really as well.
Oh, but, that sounds really nasty. I didn't mean it to come out nasty.
I don't know. Is that that?
Yeah, that I mean, that's basically what I said. But yeah, it just sounds a bit bitchy.
That's the Peter filter that has a bitchiness about it. So now in the realm of feelings, do you think, even though, like, let's say they're both groundless, but the people who have a religious worldview, do they think at the realm of feeling that they have a ground to their belief?
I'm not sure what you're asking. Sorry.
So you mentioned that your view, your values, they're groundless in a way. And then you said that the religious people, they're groundless as well, but they might not realize it. And so in the realm of like feelings or emotions, do you think the religious people, they feel more grounded than skeptical people?
Definitely. Yes. Absolutely, for sure. Yeah, that feeling of like, I don't know, it's like it's a very deep comfort to know that everything is, there's a structure underneath you that's sort of holding you and giving shape to what you feel and think. Yeah, I think that's very comforting. I think that's part of the reason I was drawn to Wicca, because it gives you I don't know how to describe it. It's like a safety net almost. It's something that, otherwise you're just out there on your own making it up. That's scary. And like, obviously I don't think people are just making up their values out of nowhere. I don't think they come from nowhere. I think they come from our evolutionary history, but it feels kind of like you're out there on your own, which is an intense feeling. And I think atheists will often sidestep talking about that feeling, or maybe just none of them feel lost like I do. But I think people are leery to talk about the feeling of feeling lost or feeling groundless or feeling like a bit like, oh, don't know what to do in my life, because they think it reflects badly on atheism. But there's this assumption that if you adopt the view that corresponds closest to reality, then everything will be fine and you'll be happy. But who wrote that? You know, maybe if we adopt the view that's closest to reality, things won't be so great. That might be reality. So I think there's a lot of strange assumptions, and there's a lot of kind of weirdnesses in the way we talk about this, because we're aware that we're representing a worldview. And maybe that's part of the reason why I can speak more freely about it, because to me, like, I could speak to an atheist, I just walk out my front door and there'd be like six of them. They're everywhere here. So what's my views? It's nothing. But if you feel like you're the only representative of atheism in your corner of the world, that's a lot of pressure. And you might find the need to simplify or to pretend things are better than they are, or all these sort of things, or whitewash. Which I think is a shame, because if we don't talk about this stuff, it never gets solved. So
right. So I'm interested in that. And maybe you can share your opinion on this and what the wider skeptic community thinks of it. So do you think having your views correspond with reality, having your worldview correspond with reality, does that automatically lead to happiness, or there's a depressive realism associated with that? Like, is your life become better in all aspects?
Good question. I mean, there's a guy, I can't remember his name off the top of my head, but I cite him in a talk I give about skepticism. Damn it. Anyway, there's a guy who's done studies on this, whose name evades me, who says basically that people who adopt critical thinking skills, which hopefully would lead you to a closer, you know, more congruent version of the world between your head and the actual world, are happier and more successful and generally live more positive lives. Part of this, I mean, there's so many confounding factors, it's ridiculous. And I haven't even given you the details of the study, so there's no reason why you should believe me, but I'll just throw it out there anyway. I think a good argument could be made for it's easier to navigate your way around the world if you have a more accurate map. And ease of navigation around the world generally does make us happier, because we can get things like, you know, food, security, safety, we can connect with other people, because we're living in the same reality they are, instead of in our own sort of strange reality tunnel that might make us very happy but fundamentally takes us further away from humanity. So yeah, I think an argument could be made that living closer to reality will make you happier, but I think, I mean, I have no idea empirically, who knows. I don't think there's nothing like to say for sure that someone will be happier if they adopt the correct worldview. you know, what I would think of as the correct worldview, I guess, right. than someone who didn't. For me, it's like, and I think a lot of skeptics feel this way too, although I haven't heard many of them articulate it. It's almost like a, it's like an urge I have. Like I'm an atheist. I don't believe in the afterlife. I think when I die, I'm gone. I'm in this world and I want to live really in it as much as I possibly can. Like I want to have, you know, I want to be here in a conversation with you and be present and not be seeing you through a filter. Right. And I realized, obviously I am seeing you through a filter. I'm seeing everything through a filter because that's all our sense data does. But I want to be as close to you as possible and as close to the world as possible. I mean, that's part of my nature geekery, you know, when I look at a tree, I want to know what it is. And I want to really like look at it and experience it. And this is where all my hippie side comes out.
Right, right. You know, like one thing about the street epistemologists, when I brought them in my club and they did a talk, I learned about them, I read the books, and I really appreciate the methodology. I thought it was really tight. I like how they kind of separate the how of what you believe to be true versus the what of what you believe to be true versus the why of what you believe to be true. Like, you know, like what's your method, what's the content, and what's the sort of like the desire, right? And kind of like having separating those three are really helpful, I find.
Yeah.
The one thing I was left uneasy is basically this question. Is it like good for everyone to have, you know, more accurate view of reality? Because if someone's whole worldview is sort of like hinging on, say, Christianity or religion, and they're pretty happy or maybe they're not happy, and maybe the only thing that's making them get by is this, and then, you know, a street epistemologist comes and acts all friendly and just rips down their whole worldview, and then, you know, like, okay, good, see you later, bye. You know, even though they give cars, like, oh, come join us type thing. But I don't know how, you know, I don't know if the evidence is there to show how successful that is. So I'm not quite concerned, but I'm a little uneasy that this might actually leave people worse off than better off.
Yeah, I think obviously like beliefs and human brains in general are super complex and you can't really tell what's going to affect what. So, you know, your belief in God, if you're a Christian, your belief in God might make you feel really happy today, but you know, in 10 years time when your kid dies, maybe that's horrible. Maybe you get all angry at God and it's like it's a nightmare and you would have been better off not believing in God in the first place. Or you make decisions based on, you know, something your faith community says is true and they end up terribly for you. Like, you know, the Christian Scientists who don't, is it Christian Scientists? I think it is, who refuse blood transfusions for their children and things like that. So considering everything is so fucking complicated in our brains and we really, like, pretending you understand yourself is a joke. No one does. It's all a mess. And for me, I think the simplest thing to do and the way to build yourself a sort of way of thinking, to sort of engineer your brain as much as you can to be a good piece of equipment for you to interact with the world and to serve you in different situations as well, not just make you feel comfortable right now, but serve you in the long term or if, you know, something terrible happens, is to try and cut down on the biases and think through things logically. And then there's all sorts of other things I'd recommend too. That's just my kind of skeptical side. The other part of me says, and you should meditate and you should do this and you should, you know, you should go bird watching if you want to live a happy life. But I really think I feel like for me, adopting the skeptical worldview helped me immensely because it's something I didn't have before. And it's scary to live in a world where you don't really know what's true and you're just going on what feels true in the moment. That's fine when what you feel is true is like fairies and stuff and, you know, building power with your fellow witches in the woods. That's amazing. That feels great. But what about when you start thinking, oh, what if demons are real? I kind of feel like they are. So they must be because that's my epistemology, right? And then things get scary. And I think, like, so that can't happen to you. Or, I mean, anything can happen, but it's much less likely to happen to you if you try and think through everything with the same method of looking at the evidence. Like you said, passing everything out into the why and the what and everything. If you think through stuff in that systematic way, then when you come to your conclusion, you can have fun with it. But at least you're not letting... I guess I have quite a negative vision of this. I almost feel like it's you're letting shit into your head. Like, why are you letting that into your head? Because you don't know what it's going to do. It could corrupt all your files.
Mm.
So that I just see that as like it's like a virus software thing, the method of skepticism that helps my brain work and helps me deal with the world. And I've seen like everyone has this story of like, oh, you know, and obviously there are millions of people like this who are super happy with their faith and it brings them comfort and joy and community and all these things. And that's wonderful. But there's also a lot of people who will tell you stories about being scared and feeling terrorized and feeling trapped. Like there's lots of bad stories coming out of that sort of believing in things that aren't true as well. So I just think to be on the safe side, let's try and believe in true things. I don't know. That's kind of, it's a bit of a woolly answer, but that's where I'm at.
So the idea is like it's an antivirus in a way.
Yeah.
Are you, there's a skeptic movement, do they like proselytize skepticism as much as say maybe the street epistemologists do? Well, they don't necessarily proselytize street epistemologists. They sort of engage in conversations with the point of doing this antivirus thing. Does the skeptic community have like an outreach aspect too?
Here and there, yeah. But it's not that big. I would like it to be bigger, really, to be honest. I feel like, especially in the UK, because everything's grassroots here and we don't have any big organizations, really. So everyone's just like, I actually just resigned from running my local Skeptics in the Pub because I moved house and I can't get there anymore. But we have this network of Skeptics in the Pub, which are just run by volunteers. And we put on talks and have like a Q&A and a drink afterwards with people. And we do get in people who are not skeptics who just come because they're interested in the particular topic. So we might have a talk about effective altruism. And people will be like, oh, I'm interested in charity. I'll go along to that. And then they learn a bit about the skeptical method because we sort of sneak it in there in the intro and stuff and then talking to other skeptics to kind of do that sort of work. And then there, I mean, my comic, How to Be Reasonable, the comic you read, that's my attempt at outreach. I was trying to write something that would appeal to like me when I was in my early 20s and was a witch, like something I would have actually read the whole way through. So yeah, there's bits and pieces here and there, but there's no, I mean, I'm sure skeptics will contact you and say, oh, actually we're doing these amazing things. And I'm sure they are. But it's very piecemeal in my experience. And I think skeptics would like to do more activism, or they say they would like to do more activism, but I don't see that much happening.
I want to talk about resentment too, or inquire into resentment with you, because I've met quite a few new atheists here, militant atheists even, and I have a sense of this with some of the street epistemologists as well. And this was very salient to me when I watched that Hail Satan documentary.
Yeah.
And I would say like the new atheist street epistemologist and Satanic Temple, they all share the same really logical space. About, you know, they don't believe in God, they have these certain values of critical thinking, but, you know, they just it manifests differently. And it seems there's like an underlying feeling of like deep resentment towards people who are religious. Maybe more so the American kind of Protestant religion. And I know that you didn't raised Christian or religious at all, so maybe that this is absent in you and the skeptic community as a whole. And I know it's sort of like the rationalist community, less wrong.
Kind of, yeah.
And I don't get that sense of resentment that they have. I don't think they have resentment towards religious people, but I feel that on this whole kind of like atheist cluster. Do you get a sense of that as well?
For new atheists, definitely. A lot of them have been really, really hurt by religion. That's why they're active as new atheists. Otherwise they'd just be quiet atheists, you know? The whole thing about new atheism is kind of being passionate about it, talking about it a lot. Passion doesn't come from nowhere. I think it often comes from pain. I actually did a survey. We were talking about this before we started recording. You can find it if you're interested at howweletgo.org. And it's a survey of people who used to hold faith beliefs who now don't, asking them why, basically. It's like quite a long, in-depth questionnaire, though. I think it took people about half an hour to complete. And I just got so much, it was such an intense emotional experience. I just put this out there like, hey, you guys, why are you atheists? Tell me, fill out this survey. And people just, I just got bombarded with these stories, heartbreaking stories of things people have been through. You know, just being rejected because of their sexuality, or, you know, being forced to go through horrible experiences or losing their family and friends, just like again and again, the same sort of themes coming up of basically being, what's the word, like excommunicated. Mm-hmm. In fact, I learned other words for that excommunication. There's a bunch of them for all the different religions have their own disfellowshipping, I think is Mormon, takfir, I think it's Islam. Like they've all got words for this thing they do where they push people out because they are expressing doubts.
Right.
And that is bound to create a lot of kind of resentful, angry atheists, I think. So I'm not like excusing us saying it's not our fault. They did it to us, the horrible religious people. But I do think that's definitely an aspect. Also, there's like some kind of selection bias there going on because we all have this idea like, oh, you know what atheists are like. You don't really know what atheists are like. You only know the ones who say, hello, I'm an atheist to you. Mm-hmm. Like, I never say that to anyone. So people would just assume I'm not an atheist, I guess, if unless I'm here in the UK. But if I was in America, and then I don't get marked down as a nice atheist. I'm not a data point on their graph. So you only notice the ones who say, hi, I'm an atheist. And they're maybe the ones who are more likely to be, you know, speaking from a place of hurt / being a dick.
Right, right. And going back to the whole excommunication piece, you know, my kind of like examination of Hermetic tribes and stuff, people are saying a lot of these things like social justice activists, that's like an open source religion. People are kind of like, they're saying they're making the same moves as religion. Mm-hmm. And is that, you think this atheistic cluster or maybe the skepticism, do they have like a religious aspect about it as well?
Yeah, almost certainly. I think that's kind of like a thing humans do. I'm always a bit like, I don't know about calling it religious, because to me, religious has to sort of involve something supernatural, because otherwise I'm not sure what the word's doing exactly. But it's definitely a common cultural formation, isn't it? To get everyone on the same page. We're all thinking and believing the same things. And then anyone who doesn't believe them can't be in our club anymore. Mm-hmm. I think that's what we'll do that around a religion. We'll do it around a political idea. We'll do it around a philosophical idea, like anything. Right. So you just see it happening again and again. The weird thing is, actually, that's something I quite like about the world of woo, and it's something that surprised me, and I think most skeptics don't realize, is we have this assumption, actually this relates to the atheism thing as well, we have this assumption that everyone has like a bullet pointed list of beliefs that they believe, and they just ticked off. Because I'm a Christian, so I believe this, this, and this, and this.
Yeah.
And actually, when you talk to people, you find there's lots of different reasons why people believe and what belief means to them. Mm. And they will often have different reason for being there and doing what they're doing. So maybe they do like literally believe every word in the Bible, and they believe it's like factually accurate. And they believe that, you know, if we had a telescope big enough, we could see God. I'm sure there are some people who think that, but there are some people who think, no, actually, you know, faith is over here and science is over here. Never the twain shall meet. And it's like, we've got an exemption zone around faith. I don't think it can be tested by science. And then there are some people who are just like complete relativists. It's like anything's true. Whatever I want to be is true. They're the most difficult to talk to in my experience. And then there's the metaphorical ones who will adopt a label like Christianity, but don't actually literally believe in the things it says. They just like the lifestyle and they find all the stories, you know, emotionally consoling and uplifting and enriching. And they're all there in the same building. It's very straight. And now I think, I don't know, people seem to be getting much less tolerant of that diversity amongst people. Like, you want to know not only what someone believes, but be very clear on, you know, all the details and their motivation. And if it doesn't match the party line,
totally. Yeah, like, I found this is one guy, he's a friend of mine. I had this like kind of debate club, like a private debate club. And it was interesting because we had all these different worldviews there and we all kind of like just went at each other. And one guy, he was a militant atheist, and it was sort of like, it was like a kind of a cartoonish archetype of a militant atheist. But when you pressed into it, like this, we had a traditional Catholic in the group as well. And then him, and then they just felt like the same person in a way, but just the beliefs were different. And when we pressed into the militant atheist, there was like how uneducated he was in a lot of areas, which just got exposed. And what it came down to is, or really what it seemed to the group, was that there's like a faith-based aspect to epistemic authorities, to like, you know, the scientific consensus. But then we pressed into like why that was or what the actual consensus was, there's sort of an ignorance there. And it seems like it was motivated more by that resentment piece, and then sort of this faith-based piece that like, okay, the scientific community got it right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, that's very tempting, isn't it? I do think that I think science, not the scientific community, but science like as a method is the best way we have for learning about the world right now so far. I'm pretty impressed with it. And it is tempting to kind of just, I mean, as we said, you've got that God-shaped hole. Why not just squish science in there? And the answer is because it really doesn't work. Right. And because science only gives us probabilistic answers. It doesn't give us that certainty that God gives. You can't really get that anywhere, unfortunately, for real, I don't think.
And Extinction Rebellion?
Yeah.
Any thoughts on them before I go on my question?
Not really, no. I mean, I don't want the world to end. So, right. So I'm kind of, but I'm behind them, I guess. I don't know.
Right. So I invited them to my club, the Intellectual Explorers Club, because I invited street epistemologists, effective altruists. I've had all these people that have different kind of beliefs in kind of to talk about it, to have some kind of explorations around it. And one thing, they gave this 2-hour PowerPoint on how the world is ending type of thing, right? Like how basically we're fucked. And it was just sort of fact after fact, spreadsheet after spreadsheet. And, I tracked a lot of it, but a lot of it I just didn't even understand. And then there was a point where just my epistemic agency shut down. And I'm like, okay, I believe this study, this study says this chart shows this. I'm like, okay, I don't even understand half the stuff, but I trust that these people do, or this curator of expertise right here that's speaking does. But then another thing that was interesting is that my body just was filled with existential dread, So it's the world's ending. Oh my God, I was just feeling a lot of fear and stuff. That was interesting. My brain shut off, outsourced my thinking, and then my body was filled with dread. So that's like a perfect opportunity to recruit somebody to something. And then it was interesting. I mentioned this because, I do a lot of these authentic relating kind of, I guess you would call it Wu type practices that give you a sensitivity towards your, felt senses and your emotional makeup. So I feel like I'm a connoisseur of my emotional reality. So I can articulate things in a very nuanced way. So I described this to him, what happened, how I shut off, and then how, what I was feeling in my body. He says, yes, the emotional despair, existential despair thing, that's exactly how we want you to feel. And in regards to your skepticism, and then he threw that word there, right? And that was very interesting because I wasn't experiencing skepticism. I was just kind of my brain shut off and I just outsourced my thinking. But he labeled me as a skeptic. And then when he said that word in front of the audience, I'm like, oh my God, I just wanted to repair that because I don't want to be a climate denial skeptic type thing, right? And so it was almost a kind of a policing mechanism associated with that as well, that whole thing. But why I bring this all up is that the world is so freaking complex, and I don't even think the experts have a real consensus of what's happening in a lot of the times. So there's a lot of if you want to accept that things are happening, climate change and whatnot, we'll have to just outsource a lot of our understanding to these experts. And one of your, I think the let me see, your definition of being reasonable is agreeing to the rules of logics and following evidence. So in this complex world with so much information, how do we actually follow the evidence?
Yeah, it's kind of an impossible task. I mean, it is an impossible task because we don't have direct access to stuff. And I think that's where, although I do think following evidence is obviously a good idea, when you have, so this is kind of what I meant when I was talking about holding ideas lightly. So it's about being quick on your feet and about saying, okay, I've heard this presentation from, what direct action everywhere or no, what are they called?
Extinction.
I'm getting them mixed up with a different group. Anyway, from the climate change people, they seem to know what they're talking about. How sure am I that what they're saying is true? Let's give it a probability, let's say I'm 90% sure. Okay. Well, that's something I can work with. And then just keep assessing that. And this is kind of what the street epistemologist will tell you to do as well. Just keep an eye on that. And just if anything ever reaches near 100, that's when you should get your skeptic tools out again and make sure.
Right.
And then you can say, well, if I'm 90% sure that man-made global warming, climate change is happening and it's bad news, then I'm going to proportion my response accordingly. So I'll make big changes in my life. I'm 90% sure, that's a lot sure. I'll make big changes in my life. I'll try and, you know, and if I'm only 50% sure, I'll make smaller changes. And I'm so, like, about everything. Just, I think one of the tools of skepticism is, because it is supposed to be about a method instead of conclusions, you hopefully should not get that attached to any belief and be ready to change when you're presented with new evidence. Mm-hmm. And you just have to keep quick on your feet, and you'll probably be wrong all the time, but maybe you're dancing a little bit closer to truth every time you move your probability marker up and down that scale. Yeah. I don't know. It's really hard. And I mean, I think it's something that everyone struggles with. I think the problem that we have sometimes is we're like, oh God, the world's so uncertain and we can't know anything and everything's scary and, you know, overwhelming. So just grab onto something and sort of commit to it and be certain about it. And sometimes that thing is not true and not good for you in all sorts of ways. Mm-hmm. So if you can just have a more like provisional attachment to ideas,
right,
then hopefully you'll be, as I say, faster on your feet to move if better evidence comes up. But you can't expect to always be right. You can't expect to always be even close to right. And you have to get super comfortable saying, I don't know, which is hard and scary.
Right, right. I like Ken Wilber's line, like, the best theory is the one that gets you to the next.
Yeah, yeah. That's great. I haven't heard that before. I love it.
Yeah. Do you have maybe like 5 more minutes?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was wanted to maybe end this off with the conspiracy theory stuff that we're chatting about before we press record. Because I've been getting into, I like to call it the parapolitical.
Okay.
It's more like a sophisticated way to say conspiracy theories. So basically like, you know, like deep politics versus public politics or surface politics, like kind of machinations that happen behind the scenes in order to influence political outcomes. So that's parapolitics. Peter Scott Dale writes about it and stuff like that. And to me, when it comes, especially if like intelligent agencies are involved, they're like probably the most sophisticated groups that can kind of hide things and make things easy or not easy to know. So I'm curious, like, this is, to me, it seems like this kind of critical thinking and like Occam's razor and stuff like that breaks down when it comes into these realms of conspiracy theories and parapolitics.
Yeah, I think to some degree it does, because it's kind of like, I mean, I see why you thought of this after talking about climate change. It's a super complicated system, and we as just normal members of the public don't have access to information about what's going on behind closed doors. So right. you can't go and gather all the evidence. You can't even hope to. You can't even try, really, because right. you only have what is made public, which is not that much. I think when I think about conspiracy theories, I'm doing that. That a big part of what I do is I look at how it resonates with me emotionally, and if it feels like, oh, that makes so much sense, or oh, that's really cool, I'll look into that. I think, that's something to be skeptical about. Because it's almost like it's, if it's too juicy,
nothing
is that juicy in real life, in my experience. Like if the narrative just fits so nicely and it's got like a nice arc and there's a bad guy and a good guy and you know which side you're on instantly. Like, oh, that seems suspicious to me. I'm gonna reserve my judgment on that. Mm-hmm. And then I guess that's like a simple way of saying, I don't necessarily think about the theory itself because I don't hope to be able to gather all the information about what they're speaking about. But I think about what function it's fulfilling psychologically for that person and for me when I hear it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And if it fits too neatly, that's when I think, oh, maybe this is just a story.
Right.
A really good story, often, like a really compelling story.
And overall, I agree with that approach, like kind of feeling into your personal motivations. It's like, is there some kind of unconscious motivated reasoning going on here that you want this like good evil narrative? And going back to Ken Wilber, another line that I like about him is that no one's smart enough to be 100% wrong. Or like, you know, broken clock tells the time right twice or something like that. So it's like, and there's a sense when you go into this like conspiracy theory, especially as a performative agnostic, when you accept it as if it's true without actually believing it to be true, it's like my body, and you mentioned this in your graphic novel, it's like my body just filled with paranoia because there's absolutely no one I could trust now. You know, like, yeah. If I accept these as true, because every evidence out there is false, or it's like, you know, people are compromised, stuff like that. But I'm wondering if there's a way you can tease out, you know, that ounce of truth that could be there, instead of just dismissing it outright, just because it's fulfilling some kind of psychological need. Because it could be both. There could be some accuracy there.
Yeah,
definitely.
And it could fulfill a psychological need. Yeah, there are some things that are good stories and are also true.
Right.
I mean, it's not very satisfying, and perhaps a skeptic who works specifically with conspiracy theories would be able to help you more. Mm. But, you know, I've got this thing of like reading everything or as much as I can. If I get interested in a topic, I'll just try and read from as diverse many sources as possible. So, I mean, whatever the conspiracy theory is, put that in, and then put skeptic, see what the skeptic community is saying, see what the people who are involved in the actual industry or Department of Government are saying, you know, just like, and then try and triangulate, like see where those different narratives overlap that might get you a little bit closer to the truth.
I like that.
I mean, I'm not very motivated to do it, to be honest, because I'm not a very political person. I don't really think that way. The like political conspiracy theories that scare other people just slide off me. I don't know why. I'm immune to them. Mm-hmm. I used to be scared of demons. Conspiracy theories are nothing, you know? But I think that's probably the best advice, and just accepting that really you're never going to know. You can only ever be, you know, however sure you can be. I mean, like, I'm pretty sure 9/11 wasn't an inside job. Do I know for sure? No. But I have to be happy with the fact that I'm pretty sure, and that's got to be good enough for me. And really, whether some woman in England thinks 9/11 was an inside job or not doesn't make that much difference to the world.
Mm-hmm. It's I like that approach. And I kind of take that approach with this sort of the culture war analysis. It's like, you know, the street epistemology, they have the how, the why, and the what. I'm really interested in getting the what right, to the point where, you know, you can pass what they call the ideological Turing test, where you can act as if you're part of their tribe type thing.
Yeah.
And then also have a sense into the why, like, you know, the psychological motivation aspect as well. And even understanding their epistemic methodology is important too. But just like, I like the what, like presenting the what of, like, you know, we're going back to conspiracy theories, presenting the what of the skeptics, presenting the what of the believers, talking about the official narrative, you know, all that type of stuff, and just lining them all up, and then just kind of like seeing if you can kind of have a through line between all of them and see if there's the truth is hiding there.
Yeah. I think that's really the only way you can approach it. And it's kind of unsatisfying, because it would be nice if I could tell you, well, just check thetruth.com. And it'll be all there. Unfortunately not.
I'm tempted to Google truth.com right now. See what comes up. All right, Rebecca. Well, that was a fun exploration.
Yeah, for sure.
What are you doing right now? Like, where could people find you? All that jazz.
I'm kind of promoting my podcast, The Seeker and the Skeptic. Go check it out. If you're interested in having conversations about what we sometimes call woo, but I feel a bit embarrassed when I do, from, you know, different perspectives, and thinking about how, you know, how these different practices and beliefs can fulfill needs for people, and how they can sometimes really hurt people. I think it's quite a good podcast. So check it out. And you can also check out my comic if you want to find out more about skepticism, which is called How to Be Reasonable, and you can find it on Amazon.
And maybe one last question. What's one thing in the area of woo that you've been exploring, like maybe one practice that you actually went to or whatever?
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, I know everyone will roll their eyes, but ayahuasca had a big effect on me. Yeah. Big effect on me. It got me thinking a lot about a lot of the stuff we've been talking about today, actually, about identity and what it means to be a skeptic and what it means to be an atheist, and how and whether those identities and labels are serving me. Just made me rethink a lot of stuff.
So you actually take an ayahuasca, or you read it? Okay, yeah. So how's that woo though? Like, I don't know.
Well, it's woo adjacent, I guess. One of the things that they do, if we're thinking of the dictionary definition, which was, I can't remember exactly, something about unscientific claims. There's one of the things that happens, obviously, when you take a drug like ayahuasca, is you see and hear and experience strange things. So there's kind of two ways you can interpret that. You can think like I do, oh, I've seen and experienced some strange things whilst I was taking drugs. Or you can say, I've pierced through the veil of reality and I've seen the truth. And that I think is, maybe it's an ascientific claim, because it's not really claiming to be scientific. But it's an interesting thing to think about, because me and Kat both went, we both did ayahuasca, we had experiences, not similar experiences actually, her experience was much nicer than mine. But the way we interpret them is different. And then of course, like when you go to do ayahuasca in Amsterdam, the people you meet there are typical hippies. Tech bro hippies. So they're kind of the woo. We've actually been planning a show showing like sort of lady woo versus tech bro woo, because there seem to be two competing things. Going to one or the other.
Interesting. Yeah, you get a woo taxonomy. Yeah. The woo tribe, you should have a spreadsheet on that.
Yes. So the sort of people who are involved in ayahuasca, I mean, we arrived at the thing and someone started reading my tarot cards immediately. It's nice. Part of that culture. Nice. So,
I recommend checking out Family Constellations if you haven't already.
Oh, I will do. Yeah. Is that the one where someone pretends to be your mother?
I think it's a little bit.
That's on our spreadsheet. It's not under that name, but we have something. Yeah, something very similar to that down.
Yeah, I went to one in Toronto, and it was very interesting. And it kind of just I won't go into details, but yeah, check it out, and anybody listening, look at that as well. I found it helpful, even though I don't believe in propositionally what they were talking about, but the actual exercise is very useful for me.
I find that so true of many of the experiences we have. All sorts of things. Like, I can see why it's helpful. And even though I don't believe everything they're saying, often, as I said, they don't believe it all either. People are there for different reasons. That's something that's really, like, in the year and a half of woo exploration we've been doing, has really changed, you know, about the way I perceive people who are involved in these practices. They don't necessarily believe, you know, they don't all believe the same thing. They don't all believe that ayahuasca is magic. There's a range of opinions. And it's fascinating. Yeah, people are cool.
Delicious complexity. That's what I like to do. Exactly. All right, Rebecca. Well, I'll include all that in the show notes, all the information. And thanks again for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me. It's been great.
All right, everyone. Until next time, keep exploring.